This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much, Aaron, and thanks for coming on a rainy and blustery night like this. It looks as if I was in the middle of a fight that I would have to announce. And as I was recently in Paris, I had to say that one of the major contributions American culture has made to the entertainment media is these debates with where people either strip or fight, slap one another. So maybe something like that will happen tonight. And I'm here in the middle, and maybe I'll call upon you to help me. We wanted to have a debate, but in fact, I'll just briefly, very rapidly, present for those of you who might not know either Osvaldo Romba or Joe Margolis, the work. I'll begin with Osvaldo. It's simpler. There is a book here that Aaron edited presenting his work. And I'll just list the cities in which he has had individual exhibitions since 1971, Tucumán, Buenos Aires, London, Antwerp, Vienna, Tel Aviv, Strasbourg, Berlin, Aachen, Hanover, São Paulo, New York, Duisburg, Jerusalem, Cologne, Tübingen, Tokyo, Augsburg, Salzburg, Bonn, Budapest, Paris, and of course, Philadelphia. And I'm probably missing a few. He has not only shown his work throughout the world, but he has also written about art himself, beginning in 1972, a book in collaboration with Gaston Breyer, Journeys into Visual Experience. And in this book you will see, and maybe we'll use this, a number of remarks on art and life, or art to art, life to life, as he writes it in one text. Well, to rapidly present Joseph Margolis's work is almost as impossible a task. He's the author of more than 20 books. I'll just list those that show that for a long time he has been meditating on the links between philosophy and the arts. In 1962, he published Philosophy Looks at the Arts, which is a good subtitle for what we'll try to have tonight. In 1965, The Language of Art and Art Criticism, and I skipped quite a number of books, but then 1995, Interpretation Radical but Not Unruly, with fascinating chapters on interpretation in the arts, and this little book that I always recommend to my students, What, After All, is a Work of Art, 1999. He's also, of course, written many other books on philosophy, interpretation, pragmatism, Heidegger, and so on. But tonight, I'm happy to see that this dialogue is, in fact, a way of going back to a very old conversation that Joe and Osvaldo has had. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about this?
Well, actually, it worked out that way, but I think almost instinctively, not by any deliberate plan. First of all, I did meet Osvaldo. I think it's now somewhat more than 10 years. We were both at a rather unusual, perhaps even strange, occasion in Buenos Aires, and then again in Israel, where I had the opportunity to write a small blurb on Osvaldo's installation. In fact, this is a photo from that occasion, and I, in a sense, then I came to the point of your remark about the dialogue by selecting a handful of prints in order to prime my remarks and also the discussion in this open-ended way. I was a little alarmed that the versus was taken literally. I think it may have something to do with the warlike times that we live in. But in order to combat that, perhaps Oswaldo and I will set a new style in how to disagree or perhaps with one another in a friendly way. But I did want to show a few photographs of some things which are actually dear to me, and they're interesting for that reason alone, if there were no other excuse. But I think they also draw attention to the inventiveness of art and of commenting on art in ways that begin to take on form merely because they're put in juxtaposition with one another. And the last set of photographs are, in fact, photographs of Oswaldo's installation in Jerusalem, which then brings us round full circle. So if we could show the first slides. I selected three paintings of Matisse. First of all, the Red Studio, which I'm sure all of these are familiar, and the Moorish Café, as it's called. In fact, I think the photo did rather well, I'm surprised, and the piano lesson. Matisse I've always found to be an extraordinarily playful artist whose wit is always subdued, so that you have to look carefully in order to see just how clever he is. For example, in the Red Studio, which interests me, many people thought that Matisse failed in the Red Studio because it turned out that the red that he used is so matte in a way that you cannot see any modeling in the red if you see the original painting. But he takes his own work chiefly and arranges it in such a way that he manages to insinuate a sense of the classic three-dimensional sense of a camera space by placing these objects, for example, the small paintings, which lean against another, which force you to think of the three-dimensional space, even though there are no guidelines which come from the standard way of representing that kind of pictorial space. And the interesting thing is that the matte quality of the red actually enhances your need to find the cues in other ways, as if it were something analogous to a kind of rebus, so that when you look at it, you actually begin to figure out why each object is placed in the way in which it does. It builds up this sense of the visual space in a way which you couldn't get if you had the actual guidelines drawn in a standard way. It's very witty. And of course, the way to see it, at least I think, the way to see it is to see this clever artist avoiding the conventions of the familiar way of representing space, but producing the effect of that by unexpected but very quiet means, so that you can't exactly see when you first look at it exactly how he's managed to trick your eye, that you finally do see it as if it's a conventional space, but it's been produced in a way which is absolutely not conventional in that way, because the whole thing is flat in accord with current views of how space might be represented. Could we then just go on to the blue, to the Moorish Café? This is a favorite of mine. I've actually seen it in the Hermitage, and it was the favorite of this man, Shukin, who bought it from Matisse. He actually wrote about it. But what is extraordinary is that it's the same conception, in a way, that is to use this kind of creamy, overall whitish quality that doesn't allow you to feature objects in the space in a way which would be conventional. But then you notice, for example, the treatment of the foreshortening of the legs, which again forces you to think of the of a notion of conventional space, which is then, I think, challenged in a marvelous way at the top of the painting, which you then see inevitably in the distance, so that rather daring that you would have these figures which are floating overhead, you might say, but because of the arches which then force you to think again of receding into the distance in a way, you recreate in an extraordinarily natural way the whole layout of this painting, plus the amusing fact that Matisse adds his favorite objects, the fishbowl and a little flower vase. You say, well, is that something you'd find in a Moorish cafe? I suppose it might have been in the Red Studio and also in the paintings of the apartments. But I mean to say this is a variation, also, of course, that it's framed in the way in which it is, which then conveys some of the standard themes of Matisse, but by a kind of almost infinite variation without any kind of strain, just a sort of natural wit in finding alternative ways of creating this sense of space. Could we then just go on to the third? Now, this, I think, is a marvelous innovation on the themes of the others, because, of course, this painting has been cropped a little because of the way it was photographed, but not to criticize Aaron for that, but there might have been a little more that one would have seen. But the figure on the right, which you think, well, why didn't he finish the painting? But of course then you realize that it is a painting of a woman on a stool, which hadn't been finished. That is, it's an unfinished painting, which is therefore finished in the painting, right? It's a finished painting of an unfinished painting, in which the figure on the stool, the mother, then has rather wittily a sort of monitoring role with respect to the boy who is, his eye is flitting metronymically, I suppose you'd say, at the piano where he's sort of captured, and again the light shaft which repeats the form. But the point I want to make is that here again he baffles all of the usual notions of how to divide the space, plus these bold treatments of just straight lines or strips of color, which you ordinarily might have trouble reading, but the whole thing manages to fall into a kind of extraordinarily natural sort of way of representing the piano lesson and the, you might say, even the psychological state of the boy who is playing. Well, could we then just go on? I won't take too much time, but we could go on to the Giotto. The Giotto, though, this is the... these are a couple of paintings about the betrayal of Christ. This is Giotto's one panel in the Arena Chapel, the betrayal of Christ, and this is a painting which Meyer Shapiro had analyzed in an extraordinary way. I think if you just have a quick look at this, and then we'll come back to it, but then if we have the next panel, the Shapiro isolates this relationship in the following way. And the reason it's interesting to me is because it sets a problem altogether different from the kind of problem which Matisse deals with. That is to say, from Shapiro's point of view, you cannot understand the painting apart from the literary text and the tradition in which the betrayal of Christ by Judas has to be understood. So the point about this painting, as Shapiro analyzes it quite brilliantly, is that for the first time, I believe he says that this occurred for the first time, that Christ and Judas, that is, Jesus and Judas, are represented in profile. That in the standard representation of the betrayal, Jesus in the persona of Christ is presented frontally. If we have the other slide, you can see this. This is a panel from a betrayal in which is in Assisi, apparently painted a generation before the arena chapel painting. And Jesus is represented almost in full face frontal. And the sense of it is that the frontal face designates the divine and the kind of changeless kind of presence of the divinity, whereas the, so to say, the contingency of Judas's role in the whole thing is conveyed by the profile, so that the relationship between the order of divinity and the order of the natural world is captured by just that kind of iconography. But Giotto, if we come back to the other for a half a moment, produces this extraordinary encounter between, I mean, it's a remarkably intense encounter in which, as Shapiro says, for the first time, you notice that in the picture itself, practically everyone is in profile. Shapiro has made a kind of general iconographical analysis of the different ways in which the face is represented, full face, three quarters, in profile, and so on. And all of this then invites an interpretation or a way of reading and understanding what the artist is doing, which forces you to bring in a kind of freewheeling sense of the encompassing culture in which the symbolic relationship can actually be read off, which is quite different, I think, as a problem from the sort of thing that Matisse was doing. That's the sort of sense that I have. That is, you can't really tell, is part of the point I want to make, that you can't really tell what the problem is that the artist is setting himself or what a critic or observer would be saying about this, except in the sense that you yourself, as a commentator, are drawing improvisationally from whatever sources you can imagine to make a kind of convincing recommendation as to how people might really look at what is before you. Now, if we have the piece, the photos of this other artist, I've forgotten his name, Romberg, right? Osvaldo. Right. I think the point is that when you come to a Romberg installation like this or other things that he's done, you have, so to say, even less constraint on how you are going to respond to the installation than you would if you were confronted with, let us say, a number of Matisse panels or Giotto or nearly any artist of the standard literature, so to say. But when you come to Romberg, you enter a space in which you're confronted with objects like these drawing tables and boards and these panels. We could look at they're arrayed in this way, but now there's another more detailed account of that. If you had the chance to look at them carefully, they're all sort of, would you say, diagrammatic representations of various kinds of architectural and perhaps even the area, the geographical space for these buildings that you have to interpret. But now what I wanted to do just to close was to read you, if I might, one paragraph from my response to Oswaldo's thing, because I think it shows you, I'll say a word about that, it shows you the, I tried to capture the openness with which anyone who tried to enter Romberg's installation would have to tolerate, so to say, in order to be able to say something that was instructive about it. Part of it is tongue-in-cheek, I might say, but I'm sure that that was not lost on Oswaldo. Oswaldo Romberg's installations are agreeably provocative. That's a quotation from someone who had commented on Oswaldo's installation. I think you hear it as a kind of common language in critical reporting of artwork and installations, in which the commentator protects his flank by saying nothing, but he says it so neatly that you have the sense that your attention has been focused usefully in the direction of entering the installation. That's the point I want to get at, that Oswaldo Romberg installations are agreeably provocative. You get the feeling. It might be a line out of Eliot. There, in a careful sentence that deliberately says nothing, you have already the streetwise critic's response to the streetwise artist, possibly the first line of a suitable review, joining at one stroke the temptation to linger a little longer than professional ennui should permit. And my eyes are not that good. You have to translate for me. I can't read it myself.
Evidence.
Is it
undeniable evidence?
Undeniable evidence.
Small print.
It's not light also.
An elder statesman. The undeniable evidence of the artist's own labor, obviously too energetic and sustained to permit mere repertorial trickery. Well, I won't go on. I think what you can see is that in describing the work in some way, I'm doing exactly the same thing which the first reporter whom I cite has done, namely, everyone perhaps does it. You learn to say things which sound suggestive, even informed and relevant, and yet when you step back from the usual critic's comments, it turns out that what this means is I'm in a space that I don't fully understand. And my point is that with Oswaldo's things, it isn't just that one doesn't understand them, it's that there isn't any assignable something which we are supposed to understand. That is, I tried a kind of reminder of an iconographical account of Giotto and a sort of knowledgeable set of remarks about Matisse. But about Oswaldo, I think there's a kind of freewheeling, responsive, but not, so to say, of a sort in which you could say he got it right. I mean, there is no clear sense in which you just get the point right. You can betray the fact that you embroider a response to the work, but there is an entirely different sort of laid-back quality in entering this kind of installation. So I offer you these things merely as provocations for the beginning of a conversation.
Well, thank you very much. And before passing on the mic to Oswaldo, I'd say that you've focused on difficulty of Oswaldo's work as conceptual work, as analytic work, and as also architectural in space, so that it is more difficult to describe, especially if we consider the fact that his first series of paintings were actually analyses of the language of painting. And this is maybe a way of returning to Oswaldo what measure are his works already interpretations of the language of painting as such, and also the history of painting or the history of the visual arts?
Okay, when we agreed to do a discussion or a chat between philosophy and art, and I took the role of the artist, I want to define which kind of artist, because you see, if I don't understand which is my frame, how we can, artists are so many, and everything is art, depends the context in which you look at the art. So there are artists for some people, there are artists for other people, and one of the things I want to define, which is for me, the concept of an artist. And the other day I was in the Leonardo exhibition, which of course I like so much. And one of the papers I wrote for one catalog in Haifa in 1975 was called Artist Understanding. I see that for me an artist is somebody who tries to understand the world through his work. And in the kind of codification that he tried to understand his work, share with other people, which is contextually sensitive to this kind of language, a lot of things and emotions, who he will, in the other set, transform immediately in his own emotions according to his programmation of culture, of his ego, or psychology. So I would like to make a reference to two, three stories that happened to me. First of all, I will say this. I see the frame of my work, or my ideas about art. If I take Leonardo and I put a line and I say l'arte cosa mentale, art is a mental thing. And then I take Duchamp, another line, and I say stupid like a painter, which means that art cannot only be retinal. And then I put in this a line who says prehistoric art. And here I put another line who says Picasso, Guernica, or Picasso, or somebody very expressive. I situate that in this square, which I just finished to create, exists a possibility of putting different kind of artists. Of course, I refer to this parallel between Leonardo and Duchamp. The other thing I want to talk a little is something real that happened to me, small story. I was in National Gallery in London a few years ago, in front of the ambassador. Can you put the painting? Yeah, that's the painting, though the slide is a little difficult to see. By the way, I think it's opposite, that's why it's wrong.
The other way.
I saw something was wrong with my eyes. Now it's okay. And the fact is that I was like 2 hours looking at the painting, sitting in the bench, and I was crying. I mean, not crying like, oh, but crying, you know? And next to me was a very well-dressed gentleman, not like, you know, sport, but very well-dressed. And also he was, so we were looking at each other for a while. Because nobody stayed 2 hours in front of a painting. One day in the Prado, they almost take me to the police because I was looking like 5 hours at Las Meninas, and they thought I was going to rob it. But you know, you need this concentration to go into the different scenes of a painting. And so finally, I took the first challenge. And said, excuse me, what are you crying for? What do you do? He said, I'm a scientist. What do you do? I'm an artist. Why are you crying? He said, because I'm emotional, I'm disturbed. I can't resist the description of the instruments of the time, how he was able to give me, through the painting, a complete vision of the world, of his time. And he asked me why I was. And I said, because semiotically speaking, I have seen few masterpieces who make the problem of the period so clearly, like to have the dead in the front, because this that you see here in front of the floor is the image of dead, but it's in anamorphosis. If you go to the side, you will see a perfect skull. And then, because when you see the image of Jesus Christ, by the way, all the signs is explained in the middle. And then on the side, the left side, you don't see it here, is Jesus Christ, but on profile. So it's very difficult that you see the image of God. But you see the image of death. And this is the idea that science is in the second plane. So, you know, you have to think very carefully. And not only that, that's one of the things who moved me. But the other one who moved me is how he disappeared. How he's able to put this problem semiotically forward, and then you don't see his hand. In some moment, you don't see any more about the painter. You see only about the phenomenon he's describing. To make you this easy, I will tell you something. I can compare this with discussion about music. For many years I have listened to Jascha Heifetz because my father was completely crazy about Jascha Heifetz. From 5 years old I was listening Yashahev didn't remember everything he plays. And I never know why I like it, because my father told me, supposedly I don't like what my father told me. But then, like 20, 30, 40 years later, I go into somebody, a Polish woman who was crazy about music, and I hear the violin, and immediately I feel an emotion, and I realize, well, this is Hafez. I didn't hear Hafez for 20, 40, I don't know how many years. I refuse. And then I was thinking, what happened with Hafez? It happened the same thing that happened with Holbein. And what happened is that after a while, you don't feel anymore the human being playing, you feel the music. And this is the phenomenon, without being mystificating, because I hate mystification, that sometimes art can produce. And this is just to make you understand, with this I close, because I'm an artist, and I'm not supposed to talk so much about art theoretically. I think that I request from an artist to be sober, to be intelligent, and to be able to say something without screaming and without confusing and without raping the observer. This is, for me, one of the expressions of an artist who wants to understand. And it's also an artist who gives us the vision of his world. If you see Leonardo, you understand the relation between the mechanic and nature. You see it. You know, I don't have to tell you that. If you look at the landscape of La Gioconda, you understand the way he can describe, pictorically, by signs, something who is a question of his time. Go on. No, but I want to see the... I don't care so much about these inventions, you know, all these things that people believe that that's why Leonardo is great, all these machines, because everybody thinks about machines. Julio Verne thinks about machines too. This is an interesting painting, though it's on glass, and I would tell, we can talk hours about the allegory, but this is not, I will see something that I think is original from me. I think that transparency of Duchamp, out of all the other interpretations of Arturo Schwarz, and et cetera, is the idea to incorporate the world. Because the fact that you can move the painting and the background is the world outside is a fantastic idea. I think that this is what finished in some way the idea that painting should be really, really, very, very, very specially specific today, because this is the painting that wherever you put it, we take the background and incorporate it. So all this dichotomy between figure and background, he creates an historical transgression, though all the movement of modern art until Duchamp was only, in my opinion, a formal transgression. And his art before Duchamp and after Duchamp, from the point of view of the kind of art that is possible to do. Though he was a provocateur, probably he was like Jean Paquet, a fantastic cultural terrorist. And I know that many people don't like ideas but only facts, though we need people from ideas and we need people with facts. And I think that the history of art is composed of both. I only explain to the public today the frame of my thinking in which place I see myself as an artist. Though I accept that there are other kinds of artists. The other day, Joel asked me in the studio, we begin this discussion in the studio spontaneously, if somebody can be producing a work of art spontaneously without thinking. And I say, it's possible, probably. I didn't see it. In 40 years teaching, I never saw a Mozart. I'm questioning if Mozart was really Mozart. I really question that. If not, it was his father who helped me. You know, I don't have any question that he was a brilliant virtuoso with the piano. But my question is, to what degree somebody's in art, not in mathematics, able to create art without knowledge? I don't think this is one of the philosophy questions that we can discuss. Because I think this is a major question, because one of the major mistakes people make when they come to me in the academy or wherever I teach is the idea that they want to express themselves. Number one, mistake. You don't have to express yourself. You have to provoke things that make other people express. Second, when you make a work of art, you cannot... This work of art, unlike you're a magician and you dream and suddenly you have a complete vision and you're able to put it in a canvas, this is not the way it happened. And third, and with this I close, I believe that art should have a vision of the world. I'm not interested, but this is personal. And paintings or installation about people showing, you know, in the shower. I'm not interested in personal narratives. I believe that, from my point of view, And I quote somebody here to me here that we talked this 15 years ago in a car. I believe that I see the artist as a Martian. This is Margulis' work, repeating something else. Somebody who see the world in a different way and is able to create icons who provoke in people this kind of spirituality, which normally we don't have in everyday life, as we can see today. And even more, I believe that art is a religion, because if somebody is not a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, very devout to his religion, I see a kind of relation between the artist and the way they learn, and the way we transmit our art to other people teaching. For me, teaching is fundamental. Teaching is part of transmitting the religion, and that's the reason why I still teach it for 40 years. And I believe that we have to teach everybody. We don't have to be like Howard or Princeton. You never know where the artist, and you always have to give the chance. I have one of my students who is 88 years old, and she's present here today. And I see that people say, well, how do you teach somebody of 80 years old? Because everybody has to be teach. So this is the concept of religion. And well, I think I have enough information to give to you. Now we can discuss. But my focus is always in art as understanding and art as an activity of the mind.
Maybe just thank you very much, Osvaldo, before returning to Joe's response to this. I'll just note that you both chose two artists somehow to exemplify your points, Giotto and Matisse, and Osvaldo, Holbein and Duchamp. It's clear that with Holbein, we had a very relevant political allegory, French ambassadors showing the anamorphosis of death of a skull. So I think there are some echoes with the present situation. But apart from this interesting commentary, I note that they do not intervene in the same way in the field of representation or the meaning of representation, to go back to one theme you often discuss in your books, in the sense that with Duchamp and with Holbein, there is something that disrupts the frontality of the painting. In Duchamp's effort at painting the fourth dimension or transparency, and in Holbein, this strange anamorphic skull that forces us to look at it differently, whereas in Giotto and in Matisse, somehow, even though you have similar effects, there is something that remains of the old Greensburgian bidimensionality.
Yes.
Is that yes, revealing? How would you somehow connect your two examples, yes, to Osvaldo's two examples?
Well, I have always found it difficult to generalize about art. there's something as strongly personal and idiosyncratic in painting as there is in the lives of the people who either paint or who visit the studios and sort of museums. And it also seems to be possible with a change in historical time, that items that once looked to have a certain kind of meaning begin to change because of the orientation of the entire society that is now viewing these things again over some interval that has passed. So there's something mysterious about these objects, as there is about literature as well, or even conversation, that begin to take on meanings so that something which seems very bland may turn out to be quite subversive under a changed set of conditions. I mean, I suppose Foucault's discussion of the Las Meninas, yes, which looks for all the world like a conventional painting, turns out with suitable ingenuity to break out of whatever the convention was that was supposed. Now, I think that's even true with, for example, the representation of perspective. Even in the early interval in which perspective was first developed in Italy and in the lowlands, the sense of the theory of perspective being in fact introduced into paintings turned out to be actually impossible. I mean, there were all sorts of compromises that had to be introduced, which turned out to have radical implications. But they look for all the world like a kind of bland application of standard views of how to represent space. So I think there is a kind of some things may be bolder and more explicit in terms of breaking out of a frame of reference, but art in its movement, it seems to me, always is testing the possibilities of holding to anything that might be regarded as a canon, and inevitably the canon keeps, in an embarrassing way, keeps being revised in order to incorporate what appear to be minor changes. I think Manet is an excellent case, where he appears to be representing things in some fairly conventional way, but it turns out to be deliberately and abruptly and radically subversive of the entire notion of academic painting. So I don't think we see that when we see these things at first, and I am inclined to think that there's no very easy generalization to be made about that.
What would you make to tie up to one provocative statement, maybe, that art is religion? Is that, that as Lado just stated, is that, you stressed the subversive element.
Yes.
And,
well, it's interesting that I emphasize the subversive element, right. But my selections were very bland. And Osvaldo takes a more measured and conservative view about the function of art, but his examples are more provocative in a way. So we've sort of changed places, which is rather a nice thing. But there's only one point I would make, and that is Osvaldo believes that the artist has a kind of vision. And my impression is that artists, like conversationalists, discover the shape of what they're doing as they're doing it. I mean, my sense is that the happiest quality of the whole thing is to find yourself improvising in a way that you hadn't quite seen you were going to do. And then the vision only comes, if there is a vision, retrospectively. You don't have it and then put it into
automatic.
Yeah, well, you see, I believe that when I pick up Leonardo, Holbein, and Duchamp, it's because probably Duchamp is one of the few artists which I feel in the same high, intellectually, sophistication, delivery, consideration of every factor. You see, I really am a modern artist, but I don't like modern art. I really despise most of modern art. And I despise modern art because I think that is superficial, mainly. The questions they ask are not relevant for me, and not all of them. But mainly, it's a process that is accelerating. It is like after the historical avant-garde and the Russian avant-garde, the process of being superficial, stupid, decorative, and banal is coming faster and faster. And so it's difficult to find an artist who make a stop, make a delay when you look at the painting, and put into consideration. And if somebody, you see, when I see Holbein, the complexity of Las Meninas, Holbein, Leonardo, and then I see modern art, even if I take Lucian Freud, even if I take Kokoschka, they're stupid vis-à-vis the great art of the past. They deal with a very small portion of the problem. I think Duchamp is one of the few artists who take representation with the same level of seriousness, intellectual capacity, and courage to go until the end of the problem, without concession vis-à-vis the beauty, and by the way, without concession to the beauty, fundamentally. I like artists who really make people think, artists who create a sophisticated, complex world, vision of the world. I don't understand artists who don't read, artists who don't, I mean, I don't understand why artists are supposed to be stupid, why artists are supposed to be no cultural. I don't believe, really, I never saw myself an artist who improvised, who was no cultivated. Picasso, with his greatness in the talent he has for virtual, I would say, variations, formally, when I read 14 biographies of Picasso, because when I was young, I really loved Picasso. And I really never thought lately that he was very clever. I think that Picasso was held because Apollinaire was there, Marc Jacob was there, and there were a group of people who were staying in the cafe. By the way, the cafe was an important intellectual thing that doesn't exist anymore in New York. People hate each other because they are in different galleries, because they are afraid that the other make $500,000 a month and the other doesn't make $500,000 a month. In the time of Picasso, probably, they went to the La Pen or wherever they were to eat, and they were all poor, so there was a kind of correlation. They were giving information to each other. This is gone, especially in America. In Argentina, we have it until 65, probably. The cafe, we discuss, we listen to the master. I think that the reason which I made this pick up, and my point of view as an artist, has always been, an artist is like a scientist in a different way. He approaches the object of knowledge by means which are different, but with the same seriousness, with the same programmation. I don't know what is art. I can't define art, but you can say that art is a kind of sensual programmation or programming sensualization of space, time, narratives, text. And if it's that, you cannot just throw the things, and things are going to happen. I completely deny, not only my work, but also my teaching, the idea that somebody can become a painter by improvising. I don't believe so. Now, I don't believe also that there's only one kind of training. There are many trainings for different kind of public. I believe that an artist cannot paint for everybody because nobody can be loved by everybody. And somebody who wants to be loved by everybody, he has to go to Freud because it's impossible. You have an idea, even if you don't think carefully, you paint for somebody. This somebody can be your friends, the group of people, your students, or some other people. But you don't paint for eternity, you are not Pavarotti, and so you have a limited space in which you address your public. And if you don't know why your public, you're an idiot. How can you paint if you don't know why your public? Which kind of language are you going to use? All these things are not teaching the academy, because the academy is a bunch of people, one on top of the other, who everybody goes like crazy horses for a different place. But the reality is that a training has to be enough sophisticated to consider the person who is going to be teach and where is going to be this person who is going to create art exposed, to which society will be exposed. And I don't deny the possibility of being an artist in a different context. It exists, of course it exists. You just open African art and you will understand that. And it functions, absolutely. But we are talking in kind of the West, in the kind of American-French combination of the last three centuries, in which this context is the art that you see in the books. There are other artists, of course, and there are other publics who will require different things. But even, you know, if you go to the great Japanese prints, who look the same for somebody like, we look at the prints of Japanese people, if you are not in the world, you look, they look all the same. Because, of course, we don't see the difference. But if you look carefully, not at the faces, but at the way, the transparency, the sense of the wood is going, the variation of the animals, how, the nature, you will discover who is a kitsch artist at that time, who was a master, like Akusai or Utamaro. I deny the idea that you don't know. I require for my public to understand. I require for my public to be enough informed. If they are not informed, okay, they will come to me if they like it. If they don't come to me, they don't come to me. I'm not going to change the way I think or the way I perform my work in order to seduce people. Though I understand that this is a degree of seduction in the work, but cannot be the first element that an artist put forward. Can be the last, probably.
Can I say just one thing? I'll just throw it out. I've thought about it some, but I have not given it the kind of proper shape. Many people have talked about this, but the painting that was initiated in France, to say the second half of the 19th century, is remarkable, partly because, first of all, artists did not have patrons in the same way that they had had patrons in the past. Now, patronage of the sort where, for example, a church in Italy might have a competition for some sacred topic, and they would either invite an artist to submit an idea for this, or there might be an actual competition for such a notion. There was a kind of control of the relevance of what was painted, and so to say the instructional power of the painting in terms of a reasonably well-shaped and coherent tradition that the artist, so to say, entered into. Whereas in the case of essentially the second half of the 19th century, French painting, or the painting of people who worked in France, and they weren't all French, of course, those people had to work very hard at selling their paintings in a way by the wit of their own grasp of what was fashionable, what was in, what would go. And for a while they had, of course, a very difficult time. But I think the second point, which is interesting on top of that fact, is that certainly late 19th century painting in France managed to produce a sense of a coherent art world in spite of the fact that there wasn't a coherent cultural world that the artist could enter into in the way in which it was customary to do. For example, I think of the famous paintings in Tuscany that represent these kinds of competitions, where each artist takes a sacred theme that some other artist has already worked on, and his skill comes in improvising a new way of representing a well-received theme. Whereas, although there were experiments of this kind in the second half of the 19th century, like Bastille Day or something of that kind, they don't compare with this other sort of notion. And nevertheless, they built up a kind of world in which something of the sort that you're talking about was actually invented, improvised, contributed to for at least the interval up to the end of the 19th century or just going into the 20th. But at the present time, there is no such world that the artist can claim to enter. And I think that that contributes enormously to the sort of sense of scatter and even superficiality of the kind of art which they produce. For example, testing the limits of possibility, having a single idea to minimalism or something of this kind, to see just what you could do at the very end, or suprematism, the sort of thing you're talking about. So I think that the nature of the social space is absolutely crucial to understand what the, so to say, the priorities will be for the artists who are practicing. And in a way, there's a kind of heroism in trying to create something which will be arresting for some interval under the condition that the artist himself knows lacks the kind of receptive structure in terms of which he or she could easily contribute in a way that they would know would be received in a certain initially favorable way, at least the sense that this or that was a viable contribution, whereas in the past that problem didn't arise. It seems to me it is entirely different in a different world. So I think art in our time, which might well be trying to recreate a kind of world, I think it sort of realizes it probably can't do it. But
As a commentary, what you say, if you go to the show of Leonardo, You will see the first room is his master, who was Verrocchio, no? Andrea Verrocchio. And then in the last room, there are the people who were the disciples of Leonardo. Now, you will see that if you have not very good training eye, you can be confused in the beginning and also in the end. Yeah. And this puts you into question that what you said before, once the system, the system de la pinture, once the system is done, and this is one of the things that you're right, doesn't exist anymore because everybody goes any place he wants. I don't think that we have to have art without options, but there have to be different games. If you play football, you play football. If you play tennis, you play tennis. All are sport, all are art, but they have different rules. Yes. And if we don't respect these codes, we are just talking like crazy people. And you are painting like crazy people. And that's why you go in front of a painting. I go sometimes, people say to me, why you don't like it? I can't begin to explain why I don't like it, because these people is playing football with their hands. And this is what I resist. But coming back to the point, which is essential to understand, that the difference between a great artist and a small artist is very little. When you see Andrea del Sarto, or you see Cosimo Tura, or you see one of the masters who were there, not Leonardo, not Raphael, not the big one, you go in the big museums and they have few paintings which are masterpieces, and the rest are symbolically representing the period in the city, Florencia or Siena, yeah. And you look, and it's very good. Perugino is very good, but something is missing, and it's very small, because God is in the details, and the masterpiece is also in the details. It's very, you know, once you begin in the game, which I'm referring, to go deeper and deeper and deeper, you arrive to a point in which you almost create an hysterical point of admiration, proposition, and looking. And this happened only a few times. But I don't see that it's possible if you want to break all the time the rules of the others, like happened today, you know, that every 3 years, we're supposed to create something new because, you know, the deer don't sell.
Yes, of course.
And I am not against the new, the opposite. I would like something so new that people don't believe it's art. When I was young, you know, people used to say, if it doesn't look like art, maybe it's art. Today, if it doesn't look like art, it's not art at all, because they will not show it in the gallery. And what is art today? A superficial panorama of a mutation of the society, which I think is important to deal with. The problem how we deal with the mutation of this society. What you see in the galleries today is true, it's art, because it shows the decadence of a society who doesn't have any ideology, any reason where to go to live for. And you see that absolutely in the art. And this is one of the qualities of art, that not in the narrative, but in the code especially. If you go to Bateson, which has a beautiful article on Gregory Bateson, who was the husband of Margaret Mead, I believe, no? The first husband. You realize that this decadence is seen not so much in the narrative as it's seen in the codes of representation. A lot to do have to do with this postmodernism, so to speak, which is a word very ambiguous and very difficult to define, who give the possibility to everything goes. And I don't believe that everything goes. There are many things who go in different contexts and different games. Tell me the game and I will tell you. But if you don't tell me the game, what are you playing? And this is one of the frames of the thing I spoke before, as art as understanding, art as something which is a process in which you make experiments, and which you play games to the end, even you don't know the results. And this is the fascinating part that we have. But I think that the scientists also don't know how he's going to finish the experiment. And he tried. It's creativity, what I'm describing now. It's not art. And I think that it's important to feel this sensation. An artist never knows how to finish a painting. The moment that he knows how to finish a painting, if he has the vision, I don't believe in that also. Mm-hmm. He has a vision completely going paint, this is impossible. I never saw one student in 40 years who does this. And not a teacher, none of my colleagues.
I think we could now open, I saw a number of gestures and so on, questions from the audience as well. Many things were said. I have a few more questions, but I'd like to leave some time or a chance for any question you might have to either Osvaldo or Joe.
So, Armando, when we were talking about what we might discuss here, there are a number of simple but useful or even silly questions that people might be asking.
statements that we began with, one was, can a blind person paint, or they can paint?
That was a question I want to ask him, because I think we are going to talk like philosophy and artists.
Right. But then there were others. There was the Robinson Crusoe approach, and can somebody without an audience, in fact, be painting? But then there was this other discussion that was interesting, in which he thought that it wasn't decadence, there was a limit to art, but conceptual art that had kind of surpassed in certain times, for you, Kossuth and others, that had come up to the limit of what could be constituent of art, and it wasn't seductive.
No, I didn't say it was. I think it was. They were in the border of the art. This is what I say to Joe, and I believe I like Kossuth, and I know Kossuth, and he comes to my parties and we are close. I believe he's in the borderline, because I believe that art is supposed to have an icon, and I think that the idea of the, for me, ideas are not art. For me, whatever Duchamp say. I love Duchamp, but I will never accept that an idea is art. Art has to be a body. A body cannot be that is two-dimensional, can be smoke, can be projection, can be a photograph. I don't see until now that I can see that a conceptual artist, absolutely conceptual, can produce a work who attracts me enough. Now, it's possible to be seduced by the mind. But a poet seduced by the mind. A teacher seduced by the mind. Is a teacher art? I don't know. He can sensualize his teaching to a degree of fascination, but it's not art.
Johann Gertz?
Because he produced incredible metaphors. Because I know Gertz very well. He married my assistant. And I see that when he did a Trojan horse in Venice, he produced a Trojan horse of, I don't know, 20 meters high, with people living in the head. So it's a great metaphor. So I don't think that it's only conceptual.
I think I'm... here we do have perhaps art versus philosophy, I suppose. It may be the corruption of my profession, but I find myself much more open to this kind of invention, which may very well violate the kind of canon or conception of what art requires. I'm inclined to think that if you allow me, that if we stood in front of a number of kinds of art that have been produced, for example, if we were looking at Schwitter's collages, would you find that was art?
Absolutely.
Yes. But if someone said, I don't find that really serious, it's a form of play or something of that kind, and it is ornamentally not bad. You might imagine a wallpaper that you could make from it or something. It might annoy you. I can well imagine that. But is it the case that the person who, that your conception of including something like Schwitter's collage is in accord with the notion that you previously formulated in such a way that, Campbell Soup, the Campbell Soup painting, couldn't conceivably be. Could you say that?
This is the question?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
You can.
A collage of Schwitter is a visual fact in front of you.
Yeah.
When we speak about Kossuth, if we talk about the chair of Kossuth, which is a chair, the photograph of the chair, and the dictionary definition, I feel that it can really be considered practically. The problem is he took away the chair and the photograph, and this will become the problem. He becomes so crazy about his own system, he takes the reference. It's true, because yes. I know. Yes. He begins to do this. But what means the chair, the photograph, and the text? It means the ambition of the Renaissance, a complete representation. He has the icon, a representation of the icon, and the Platonic definition of the icon, which is a dictionary where you found the Platonic definition. This is okay, because he's confronting domains of language, reality,
and fantasy or reproduction.
Yes.
Well, I see that this belongs absolutely. And that's the, oh, when he made the no. glass, four glasses, and he put transparent no. glass, como se dice, inclinado? I don't remember the English word for that. Like this. Okay. Oh, and square. That's okay too, yeah. because he plays between what you see and what you know. He mediates
yes.
in what you see and what you know. This is perfect.
Yeah.
The problem is to go in this definition, crazy. Somebody who doesn't respond to Pavlov. Well, depends. He put it very big in a special context,
yeah.
can produce a performance.
Yes.
I'm talking about visual art. I'm not talking about performance.
No.
I'm not talking about borderline activities like Sadomasochist performance, Gina Payne, Marina Abramovich. Which is a different thing. We are talking about painting this moment. I never put
no.
this in the context of other kind of performing artists.
I'm agreeing with you at the beginning, so to say. What I'm suggesting is that there may be a more labile view of how to bring in these ways of working which appear to weaken the central role of the icon, as you put it, but which don't eliminate it, but test the limits of what we could tolerate in the direction, let us say, of conceptual art. So that, for example, in the minimalist work that has been done in America, there's a fascination with bringing the icon down to a kind of minimal form in which nothing of an accented interest actually occurs, and then to see what one could make out of that in terms of conceptual considerations which are playing with the limits of what we could tolerate with respect to the icon.
Yeah, but this is an experience
right?
to deal with
but it
of the
might,
icon.
It might minimize the actual
yeah.
iconic value.
Yeah, the same is true for Grotowski, Theater of the Truth in Poland.
Right.
I agree with that. That is the contra-reformism
yes.
of the Baroque,
but,
in a sense.
But would you regard
so that's
that
part
as
part of
visual?
The discourse of painting or the discourse of sculpture. The problem is when I go out of the discourse completely and talk a language which doesn't touch the icon and not the absence of the icon. Because I don't see minimally conceptual art as the absence of the icon. I see it
yeah.
much more radical than that.
Yeah.
Because it stays in the idea, not in the absence of the icon.
Well,
minimalism is a tendency to
yeah.
the absence of the icon, but also related to the aesthetic of Jean-Paul yeah. Sartre in
right.
L'Imaginaire.
Right.
And it's because the more you take away, the more you facilitate the projection of the observer vis-à-vis the object.
Yeah.
And this is okay. You still yeah. work with the concept of visuality, the body. I see that the body, we have bodies.
Yeah.
And we have sex. And the sex are different for me,
yeah.
for, at least. So when I approach anything, it's like a cell. You know, it's like a photo cell. I play with that in my installation.
Yeah.
If you see, you walk my installation, I relate to the body. And I relate to the eyes, and I relate to the memory.
Yes.
And I believe that this is the reason why I insist in the idea of having an object, or an object who is almost disappearing, still an object, because make me aware, like the work of Beckett, the work of the absurd of Ionesco, it is part of a 0-10, all the time the irreversibility, of the dealing of the artist.
Yeah.
That's why I said Malevich, and I think Malevich is very important.
Well, I agree, and I but exactly, but it is in fact an effort to see how you can, how much depth of, shall we say, of a significative sort, you can invest in forms that on one level are not interesting in themselves visually. That is, there's a definite sense of minimizing the arresting quality of the actual visual form. Although what is arresting is that you're asked to pay attention to this form which has been minimized.
If we go on with the idea of the disappearing of the object, supposing we take the black and black of Malevich,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And then we go until the vid of Yves Klein in Paris with the
okay.
gallery empty,
yeah. Yeah.
nothing.
Yeah.
Okay,
Now, it's a difference between almost disappear, the contrast. Then you go to the bead, and the difference is with the bead you can do it only one time. The second time you do the bead in the gallery, it's absurd, ridiculous.
Right,
and this,
but,
is what, this is what is important for the project of the religion in art. Yes. What you let to the others to go in.
I agree.
I don't think that people want to die and let the children, don't care about the children, at least if they don't go to the psychiatry. You care about your children. So an artist supposed to let, probably very moral,
right.
supposed to leave a trace in which other people can take and go on. When you see Malevich, and because you still have an attitude which is possible to come back to the obsession and the obscenity and whatever you want, or you can retract. When you see the bead, and that's why Yves Klein goes all the time in this kind of almost suicidal work of art, by the way, acting in the form of photography, jump in the space, which is the sea of his credo of emptiness, which connect with his idea of Zen, religious, etc. So there is a very fine line in which the conceptual stop to be physical and stop to be visual. And so there is a, I always say, there are conceptual artists who are more interesting, less interesting, but I remember the time in Brussels, because it was the capital and Antwerpen of the conceptual art. Everybody was there. So they will come before the show 5 minutes. We will drink the champagne. They will be push pins and put 10 pages that they just type in the afternoon. And everybody will do art, because it was very easy to pay a ticket. They come with a portfolio, chuk, 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 and there was a show. And you look at the thing.
Yes.
And I think it's okay. It can be, if it's Lawrence Winner, will be more interesting because the kind of text he will write than somebody else. I still miss the soup of my mother there.
Right. Yes, question.
Yeah, I'm interested in the following sense. I think that there have been at least three different types of agency that are constantly in our discussion. We talk about tradition, which I think is a third language that allows for the possibility of discussion of form and content and movement and color. And we have talked about an audience that has to be educated to understand that, that provision. And I think that we are also talking about the artist himself, who in effect enters that provision and leaves a legacy. But I think in these three kinds of ways, we're basically talking about art as a communal exercise that cannot really exist in the absence of that context. If I were to bury a cross and it's discovered 2,000 years later after Christianity is gone, let's say, that cross may be two pieces of iron, but it won't not be anything sacred. And I think it's in that context that art becomes art. It is in the context of attribution on the part of these three agencies, it seems to me. So I'd like to ask to what extent the question of attribution, of what is and what isn't art, is now fractionalized. I guess that's my
question. Is it what?
Fractionalized.
Oh, yes.
There's basically no authority that says this is art and this is not. And therefore, the limits of what it is art and what it is not, what is not art, seems to me is up for grabs. And so my question is, out of these three different agents in the formulation of art, which you think are going to, in a way, needs to be reformulated, reconstituted in order to make possible the idea of an art that is separate from any other object?
Sure.
Either one of you.
Well, I'll make a start on it, Braulio, if I can. This goes back to the point I was making before about art before the revolution of 19th century painting. I mean, I agree in a way with, I have to confess, I like certain classical figures much more than I do certain contemporary figures. Piero La Francesca is one of my favorites, and it's clear that this would fit very neatly with this account. But I think that artists in the past, as I say, responded to a well-formed, familiar tradition, community tradition, which they then worked in, and there was an immediate sense in which what they were doing was probing the possibilities of this common tradition. Whereas a lot of theorists of art make a great point of the fact that modern artists or increasingly contemporary artists don't really know the world, so to say, that they're reflecting iconically, so to say, in their work. And that, for certain theorists, well, for example, Adorno, deepens the significance of the artist's response to a world which he somehow is open to. He has that kind of gift of reflecting the tradition to which he belongs, but not in a way that he fully understands, so that it takes the interplay of all of these three personae that you mentioned in order to recreate, to whatever extent is possible, a sense of that historical space in which the artist is reflecting, perhaps profoundly, but not necessarily in just the way that that Oswaldo speaks about centering on the iconic, that becomes increasingly difficult. I remember, for example, the kind of controversy which developed about Anselm Kiefer, for example, and particularly with the use of materials which were not standard in painting, as he threw metal and cloth and hair and everything else onto the canvas, because it was a sense that a certain kind of intensity, which with regard to his particular way of recovering the tradition, somehow could be represented, or at least he felt that. And I think there's something in what he did in that sense. But he himself seems to have been naive about the implications of his own work. Now, that may be necessary in our time, since the world in which this work is done is itself fragmented. And the artist, perhaps leaning in the direction that Oswald is talking about, is instinctively trying to create some kind of, see some sort of unity or order in the chaos of his contemporary world. Now, is that a violation, I was asking before? And I think that the theory of what is central or peripheral in the art world is not unrelated to this question of how we're to understand the increasing introduction of conceptual aspects to the work that is presented. That may be the only way, with respect to painting at least, music perhaps.
I don't think it's possible to do a work of art without conceptual.
I see you. I don't mean that, but you mean that...
No, the conceptual idea, I think that the problem is the concept goes to systematization or the concept goes to derivation.
Yeah.
And in the time of Leonardo, the concept goes to clothe himself in the idea of the world, and now it's prey. Don't misunderstand me. I don't believe that it's not possible to make art if you don't make a sculpture or a painting.
No.
I think also, answer the question of Braulio Muñoz, I think that we are in a mutation of a society, and we don't know the results yet. When everybody say what is going to be, I think there is a problem with the art that we are representing, in which I include myself, is that we are in a borderline of a society who is finishing with many of the ideologies and the possibilities, and a new society is going to come. And I don't know how it's going to be, and I don't want to be here when it's going to be, because I guess that it's not going to be the kind of society I would like. But I think that we have to set, before any discussion, what is the categorization, how we look at art. And the thing who has been doing probably the maximum influence in the period that Joe is referring, which is from, I would say, Manet, with the last traditional painting and the first avant-garde painting, if you agree with me, I think that the categorization we are doing is not anymore tradition, is not anymore craft, but is much more the degree of contribution. If you listen to, the other day I was listening to the radio, and there was something, well, this is Mozart, no, what's Haydn? And again, a small thing here. We don't have this tradition. We support a lot more of theoretical things in the 19th century, in the 20th century, because we don't have the tradition. So we replace tradition by concepts, by rules, by philosophy. Now, I'm not denying the idea that I have another kind of fantasy, that sooner or later we don't have... I don't like paintings in the walls myself. not only I don't collect, I cannot see paintings in the wall. In the house where I passed part of my life now in Brazil, I have nothing in the wall but, you know, a fishing the device. And I'm so happy that I don't see images. Now, if I will have to see an image, I have it in my mind. I can close my eyes and see any painting that I remember. And I remember all my paintings and all the paintings of the others. I see that sooner or later what is going to happen probably is that we will have a generator of image generator in the house, and we will see, we will connect with the computer. This is a terrible thing, but it's going to happen. We will see a National Gallery, the ambassadors, and we will have a perfect projection, almost sensorial, on the wall. This is the future. And I have to accept that it's difficult for me, because I talk the opposite, but the fact of what I like is not the fact of what is going to happen. Now, I see that we are in the end of a period of art. And the decadence of what we see in the art is part of the decadence of a society who pretend to be democratic and is not, who pretend to be like this and is not. The art is representing this society. The problem is that if you have some degree of morality in your work, you try to avoid to be like this. Like, everybody in Argentina, everybody take money, kick back from everybody. You try not to do it because you feel very bad if you do it. So this is a lost world, and it's a lost world of art too. And we are the last, probably, Moicans who are trying to do this thing. But there's nothing wrong to be one of the last who close the door. And probably all the work who happened after Pollock in painting, I'm referring to painting, though nobody knows how to resolve the problem, were trying to go out of the situation by doing, like Kiefer, Schmalze opera German, and the other Italian light Sorrento, the Italians, because they don't know where to go. So the people who I consider serious, which is fundamental painting, Analytic Malerei in Germany, supposed to pass in Paris, were people who were trying the last thing which are possible to do with painting, support, surface, color, forms. In the context of the West, in the context of this history who come from Giotto, Arena Chapel, until today, they cannot ask the politician and the warriors to the artists what to do. Probably if they will ask what to do, we have a better world. But the situation is very pessimistic, in a sense that if you consider innovation and contribution one of the rules of this kind of art we are talking again, and of course, Braulio, that doesn't include social painting in the Soviet Union, doesn't include one of the few experiences which is superb and extraordinary, who is Diego Rivera in Mexico, and not Frida Kahlo, who is a bad painter of summer. I'm talking about the great Diego Rivera, with his incredible design, imagination, tradition, etc. There's not almost anything that you can sustain that is representing exactly this tradition to the end. We are in the end of closing a lot of things, and we have to accept that, because this is the reality.
Community of painters have lost a language that I think is common to that community. That doesn't mean society, it's just a community of painters that have a particular tradition, that have a particular departure point and a particular possibility for rupture. Without a tradition, you cannot rupture anything. That's one of the things you have to understand. The other thing about, of course, after the 19th century, we have lost the idea of the misunderstood genius of the painter. The idea that somehow we can have this notion of, in the Kantian sense, of a kind of glimpses of a new world through a mind that is privileged to see that seems to have been gone since about, I guess, before the First World War. But now, by now, from what I hear from you, it's basically gone in the sense that there is no such a thing as a genius that somehow is touched and somehow produces a thing out of nothing. That's gone. And so there are two agents that are somehow, it seems to me, that no solution is going to come from those areas. The other solution, the other agent that I mentioned earlier, society at large, the community of people. And it seems to me that society, you both have mentioned, is also fractionalized. It's fractionalized to the point where it seems to me there's boundaries between what is considered art and what is considered crafts or what is considered, any other kind of stuff. It's incredibly blurred. It's a blurring of genres in such a way that it seems to me that the society as a whole no longer believes critics who tell them what painter what art is. And that I see, by the way, on this one, in parenthesis, I argue that it's a good thing we sometimes don't believe the critics. But nonetheless, the point is, it seems to me, from what you're saying is, and you just said it, that is, it seems to me that a situation where there's no, almost like there's no next step.
Difficult steps, I will say, for my experience. Now, everyone who's young and in a school have the right to believe he's going to save the world, and I think it's good that it's happened. I think it's formidable that they have hopes. I think it's great. But I don't think that the paradigm, again, we are talking all the time about the group of people who were in Occident, who exporting the art of the West. There are other kind of art, and also it's possible that it's not important, this art, it's important the relation of art. I mean, if somebody paint Kitsch, whatever, Kitsch is today okay, but if somebody paint X, and some people feel enormous amount of sensibility, it's okay with me. I don't believe that we are, I mean, I believe that it's good, that it's this pluralism. And I believe that it's good that some people believe that to paint flowers is good, and they buy flowers, because we have to accept this pluralism, because the central idea that two capitals, Paris and New York, will dictate what is the art of the world is ridiculous. The problem is that from the point of view, not of the taste, from the point of view of, as I said before, the only category which is contribution, who wants to paint like Leonardo today? I mean, what is he going to paint? This is a question. If you can't paint like Leonardo, what you will do? What you can represent? So this is a question who put exactly the frame in the problem. There is no comeback. There is difficult. We go very slowly forward. We remove the ideas like this, and we have to, in this context, though I believe there is solutions, but solutions which are more individual than the collective in their world. I'm talking about the problem of the art, visual art. I'm not talking about other things. And we always, also the idea of the interpretation comes here very, another problem. Because when you go in the past, in a church, and you see a naked guy with a lot of beard and hair like this, and a small, como se dice, un corderito, small lamb, you don't need to go to the critic, you know what Jesus Christ. The problem is that you're in face of three triangles in a circle, and there is no lamb, and there is no Jesus, so who is going to tell you the traits of the medieval? This is the problem. But it's not anymore the problem, because today people even don't want to understand the spirit of the abstraction like Kandinsky in 1913. But people want to put something on top of the sofa. And then we come to the big problem of the decadence that we don't say clearly, which is art not as understanding, which is my point of view, but art as entertainment. Now, who I am to say that it's bad to do art as entertainment? Maybe entertainment is the way that the new Cosa Nostra in 500 years, we suppose that was the Renaissance painting Jesus Christ. The problem is that I resist the idea of entertainment, but I see that it's almost what has happened today. I mean, if you go to Chelsea, you will see the visual entertainment. It's good, it's bad, I don't know. I was, you know, we try to give to the next generation the values of our generation. We try to give to our children the values in which we were grow. And we never succeed to create good children in this way. We have to let them go and create something else, who refuse, in a way, our tradition of painting, our ideas of maybe entertainment is the future. Maybe entertainment for corporation with a little surrealism that you can see in the Guggenheim today. If you go, maybe this is correct. But what is important in the discussion, in my opinion, Joe, whatever happened today here, what's important is to understand to what degree to speak about art is not a category of not knowledge, it's a category of knowledge. And like every other discipline, if you want to understand philosophy, you just don't speak what you like. You need to read more or less which are the opinions of each one of the philosophers from the beginning of Greece until wherever. And I think that people don't want to approach art ever as a thing that you should know. They want to feel. And what happened in the end, the main discussion is to feel and to know. This dialectic is the big problem. People pretend to feel in front of art and not to know. And I think that it's very difficult to feel if you don't know. And also you cannot change what you don't know. The first thing to change something is to know what is the problem, and then you can change it. And the first thing for an artist is to know what is the problem of discipline in order to change it.
I'll risk saying just one last thing on this, because I think we should give our audience a chance to speak. We are obviously impressed with different aspects of this complex world we live in. I'm impressed with the fact that technology introduces changes more and more rapidly and more globally, and forces the membership of every society to come to terms with the possibilities of these new technologies. But it takes a long time to absorb a changed technology, and in the past, the environing culture was not fragmented. When a new technology was introduced, there was time to absorb it and to find its implications. And in your sense, therefore, they could come to know what the problem was, in a sense. Whereas it seems to me that the way we live now is such that we have, first of all, the invasion of every culture by people from all over the world, who are, in effect, either disorganizing whatever is the unity of that culture, or they produce small cultures within the geographical space and have very little to do with one another. And on the other hand, we have powerful, unbelievably powerful technologies which change. We see that changing generations in a radical way, where you get the feeling of, I know this in my own life, I'm a living fossil of the kind of change that I'm speaking of. I see that for younger people, the changes they absorb instantly, I have trouble making sense of. Now, it seems to me that artists, if we can speak generically, are trying to tame these new forces. And I, for one, am sympathetic with the effort to try to see what the possibilities are, because in Braulio's sense, the work is the work of an entire community. People are trying to contribute. They may not see it that way. I see them as contributing to the understanding of the entire culture in order to rebuild whatever they can rebuild in that space, which won't go back to whatever we knew in the past. From that point of view, I feel hospitable to the work of the new artists who, by comparison with what we know and love in the older tradition, cannot possibly compete on the same level. On the other hand, they're doing something which seems to me to be significantly different from what was done in the past, and I think we're working towards some way of humanizing these new technologies in a way that we couldn't possibly do, along the lines that you personally and I secretly also favor. So I'm playing a double game here. My heart is with a certain traditional arts or forms of artistic expression, but my head is with the new people who, I think, in rather a courageous way, are trying to give an entirely new sense to this. So if they say, look, I don't think it's painting any longer, that may itself be the way in the past there used to be this terrific quarrel about, is easel painting dead? Right? This was a much debated question. It was an absolutely pertinent question, because what it was drawing attention to was that the forces in the society were obliging us to consider new constellations in which work would be construed as productive. I myself think that your installations are an example of that kind.
I'm a radical artist. Huh? No question.
Yes, well, that's it. That's my, so I want to co-opt you, but you want to co-opt me.
No, the problem, I'm not questioning the technique or the laser, I'm not questioning the digital, which I use, by the way.
My
last movie is totally digital. I'm questioning the vision of the world. I'm questioning the humanism, which I belong to. And it's not because there doesn't exist other things, it's because I still prefer to think in terms of humanism, or things who can really integrate or let a testimony or provoke a kind of reaction.
Well, I wonder, just to try to conclude, and then we can discuss with a glass of wine, if what has ended is the sense that there is a dominant paradigm that would be like the history of painting or the history of representation, And even in the rapid history of modernity you were sketching from Manet to, say, Duchamp, there's something that has exploded and that has left maybe technology as an endless resource. One of the teachings of the new technologies for me is that they do not rule out the older forms. They leave them side by side, and you can, in the same room and with the same time, the same day, be playing with virtual art on the computer, have a painting in your bathroom, and have an object that will be some kind of a parody or kitschy reproduction, and all this will be side by side. Yes. In that sense, Duchamp would have won, because I think this is to that moment that he was leading, by forcing art to acknowledge that its own historicity was bogus, was fake, and that you could do more or less anything you wanted, provided you were intelligent, smart, exciting, funny, and so on. Any response? Well, maybe. Thank you very much, and then we can continue the discussion. You're welcome to a glass of wine and some snacks, and if you have more questions.